Hello and welcome to Say That Again Slowly, the Cambridge Festival podcast where students at Cambridge University chat with the experts who have contributed to the festival. We try to pair up students with researchers and authors from very different disciplines to bring things back to basics, so there are no stupid questions here. My name is Claire Watt and I'm a PhD student in English here at the University of Cambridge. Today, I'll be interviewing Chris Wakefield of the Cambridge Archaeological Unit, who will be giving a talk entitled Digging Up the Past, the Archaeology of Must Farm at 11:30 a.m. on 23rd of March as part of the Cambridge Festival. So welcome, Chris. Can you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about what you do?
Yeah, hi. My name's Chris, and I've been an archaeologist probably for about 15 years now. And I get to have the really exciting job that I'm an archaeologist. So that means that I dig up material from the human past to find out more about what people were doing. And that can be a human past as long ago as 360,000 years, way up to kind of Victorian period. So it's if you've got any interest in history, chances are we've been digging up something from that period.
Okay. So is your role very hands-on? Do you actually literally get in the ground and dig?
Yeah, it can be so. A little bit less so now. I've kind of worked my way up a little bit. I don't get to be digging on site as much as I used to be, which, to be honest, given in the winter, that is actually a good thing, really. But yeah, very much so. So most archaeology in the UK, about 90% of it is done before development happens. So that's before new houses are built or roads are extended or even quarries kind of move into new areas. And as part of that process, archaeologists and teams of archaeologists from all over the country will go in and examine the ground before any of that stuff happens. So yeah, we're out there all the time digging up to find out what is there and studying that material to really kind of clear that archaeology before any of that development takes place.
Oh, that's interesting. So your talk for the festival is about Must Farm. Can you tell us what Must Farm is and where does it come from?
Yeah, so Must Farm is easily the most exciting project that I've ever worked on as an archaeologist. I mean, it's one of those sites that is almost a kind of the thing you see in a textbook when you're studying archaeology. And to be part of one of those projects is so exciting. So I mentioned before quarries. So Must Farm is actually an archaeological site that's on the edge of a quarry. And that's how we're able to discover it, because the site itself is actually buried around 2 meters below the ground surface. So had that not being kind of there in the first place, we would have never even known it existed. And effectively what it is it's the remains of a Bronze Age homestead, like a little village, and the houses there were built on stilts over a river channel and surrounded by a fence. And probably only 9 months to a year after that whole settlement was built, the entire thing burnt down in this massive inferno, and everything there fell down into the water, where it was covered over with sediments and silts. Ready for us to come along almost 3,000 years later, and we were finding pots with food in that the people were eating. We were finding fragments of the textiles that they were making, all of the different tools that they had. So it's this incredible kind of glimpse into the past that we would never normally expect to find as archaeologists.
That's really interesting. I think I read somewhere that it was described as England's Pompeii.
Yeah, certainly. So, there are some sort of fancier marketing people than we are who they really like this idea of kind of Britain's Pompeii, because Pompeii is kind of this sort of moment captured in time from this volcanic eruption. So while we don't have a volcanic eruption over in Peterborough, we've got this moment that from this fire, it's basically preserved this little glimpse into the past, and everything that's from that site was what would have been in an everyday home from the Bronze Age. And most of that has survived for us to find. Which is just, I can't really emphasize how exciting it is to be able to kind of step inside the homes of people who are living in 850 BC.
Yeah, so you say it's located near Peterborough. Is it a site that people can come and see today?
So great question. So it's just outside Peterborough on the outskirts of the town called Whittlesea. Unfortunately, there's nothing remaining at the site now. So the reason that we kind of went in to excavate it in the first place was because there were kind of concerns or queries about the preservation. The site, so much of it had been preserved by being underwater and waterlogged, and there were some slight concerns that the waterlogging was changing. So if we didn't go in and excavate or remove all of the archaeology, it might not have been there in the future. So as part of the excavation, we basically recorded and dug out everything that was associated with that But I can say that the material that we've dug up, some of it is actually on display in the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology in Cambridge at the moment as part of the Beneath Their Feet exhibition. And there's also going to be some exciting exhibitions coming up at Peterborough Museum very, very soon as well, where people can go in and see some of these incredible finds that we've dug up out of the ground.
Okay. Were there other sites in the area, like around Peterborough, Cambridge, or is this the only one that we have because it's the only one that still exists, or yeah?
So what's really amazing is that Muss Farm is part of this really, really rich landscape around Peterborough, which we call the Flag Fen Basin. So there's a really famous site, Flag Fen, which is a similar Bronze Age site, a little bit earlier than Muss Farm, and that was dug by an archaeologist called Francis Pryor, sort of in the 70s. So Muss Farm is kind of just one of a lot of really interesting Bronze Age sites from around that area. But what's fascinating about Muss Farm is that it's the only site that we found that's built on stilts over a river from this period in the Late Bronze Age in the whole of the UK. So there are similar sites, but they're located in Europe in the Alpine Lake villages. So what's really fascinating is this is the first time we found this archaeology in Britain. But what's really tantalizing is that all of the evidence from the site suggests that there are lots more of these hidden and buried throughout the fens. But we've just never been lucky enough to find one in the past. So maybe in another 50 years or in another 100 years, we might come across some more of these settlements. So, this is the first one that we found, but that's not to suggest that it's the only one. There's probably lots more out there buried 2 to 3 meters below the ground surface. And unfortunately, we don't tend to be able to dig to those kind of depths usually as archaeologists. So we're keeping our fingers crossed that that might happen in the future.
Okay. Do you know why people decided to build the settlement on stilts if it wasn't kind of necessarily that popular in England? Well, we're not sure.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And there's kind of a lot of different. The tricky thing with prehistory is that we don't have any written records or any written evidence. So a lot of this is kind of educated guesswork from the archaeologists that are working on the project. So we think that people were kind of moving into these environments because in the before the Bronze Age and the Neolithic, people kind of discover farming and they kind of domesticate crops and animals. And we think that when that happens, population sizes start to increase. So it might be that people are having to live in new areas that they didn't traditionally live in before. Like the fens are very wetland, so it would have been a bit more of a challenging environment to live in. So building a house on stilts over a river is pretty much a great way of kind of, living in an environment that is slightly more tricky. You're safely above the water level, you've got a nice cozy home that's not going to flood. But we know there's lots of resources there for people to use, so they can fish in the rivers. There's kind of waterfowl and things like that that they use as well. And the other thing we definitely know is so in a previous phase of excavation at Muss Farm, we actually found 9 log boats. So we know that people were actually kind of canoeing up and down these river channels, and it was almost like a roadway for people to kind of go through these landscapes. So actually putting a settlement over this river channel would maybe have given you access to trade for people who are going around on these kind of waterways. So it's probably, even though it seems like a slightly inhospitable environment to us today, actually probably back then it was, a great site to build their homes.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Do you know anything about the kind of industry that these people were involved with? Were they kind of at war with anybody, or kind of in contact with any other settlements nearby? What do we know about them?
Yeah, so it's really interesting, and I guess that kind of touches on the question of why this site burned down. And we know that the Bronze Age was probably a little bit of a violent time to live. So we found swords and spears at the site, and more widely in the Bronze Age, we know that warfare was taking place. We often found weapons and things more widely. I mean, it depends which archaeologist you tend to speak to. So there are some archaeologists who would pretty much say that the Bronze Age was, full of war. It was going on all the time. You'd kind of, almost step out of your doorway and there'd be a severed head flying around because, everyone was really engaged in kind of conflict. Whereas other archaeologists would say that it was probably a rare occurrence, and a lot of these weapons and things are sort of symbols of power and status. I think in reality, there was war going on. It's probably somewhere between those two sides. So actually, the reason that the site could have burnt down could have been because of one of these kind of conflicts between people. We know that nobody seemed to die during the fire that broke out. We haven't found any human remains during the excavations. But as with archaeology, there's often multiple ways to interpret things. So one of the other kind of reasons that the fire could have happened is an accident. So in fact, that the preservation was so good at this particular site that we had over 18,000 pieces of the building survived in terms of the timber and wood that was used to build those structures. And we know from that evidence that they were very, very close together. So if one of them had kind of accidentally fire, it would have been very, very easy for all of them to go up in flames very, very quickly. So, it's something that we don't tend to emphasize in archaeology, or certainly not the kind of, if you watch archaeological TV programs, they usually give you the answer that happened. Whereas here, we've got lots of different things that could have happened, and it's very hard for us to say which is the correct reason. You know, that's something that we're always trying to discover, but it may be that we never know the answer for sure.
Kind of ironic that a water-based settlement caught on fire.
It's fascinating, really. And it's that combination of the kind of the heat of the fire and the water of the river that actually created these amazing preservation conditions. And one of the really cool things about it is if you imagine these buildings, when they start to catch fire, one of the first things that would actually be burnt away in the fire is the floor. And that meant that all of the materials, so all the contents of those houses, fell into the water below. And we know from doing environmental analysis that the river was very, very shallow and slow moving, and it had loads and loads of weed and vegetation and things in it. So all of those fines that dropped down into the river actually stayed in the same place they would have been in the buildings. So when we analyze that material, we can actually look at where rooms were inside these structures. So we could have walked into one of these houses and said, you know, to your right in the northeast of the building would have been the kitchen. That's where they were making the food and cooking the food. To the left, they would have had live young sheep living inside the buildings with them. So actually, it's almost like we're able to do almost like an estate agent tour of one of these Bronze Age houses because of this amazing preservation. And that's thanks to that fire and that really interesting combination of the two different extremes.
That's really interesting. Did you find anything particularly sort of different or similar to how they tended to lay out their houses? You're saying that they had kitchens and separate eating and sleeping areas, I guess.
Yeah, so I mean, this is something that archaeologists have really only kind of speculated a lot about during the Bronze Age of the past. But these buildings, you know, were able to actually sort of say with confidence, you know, what a kitchen would have contained, what an average household would have contained. So we know that people would have had wooden troughs for food. We've got stitched bark platters that they were using for bread making. We still have the dough surviving on some of those. I mentioned before that we had the kind of contents of some of the bowls of food. So this is pretty much one of the first times we're able to kind of recreate Bronze Age recipe cards. So we know that they were probably eating honey venison, which is a really interesting combination that doesn't sound too different from today. Alternately, though, they were probably creating kind of meaty porridge type stews, which I don't think they sound particularly appetizing, but obviously were very, very popular during the Bronze Age. And yeah, what is interesting is there's a lot of similarity in terms of, you know, they had kitchen spaces, they had sleeping areas, but there are, you know, kind of differences. So if you imagine, you know, going into one of the rooms of your house today and having a load of sheep living and pooing inside the house that you're living in, which is, you know, very, very different kind of hygiene standards than we would have today. So yeah, we found sheep droppings that have been preserved all this time actually inside the structures as well.
Do you have any idea, like what it is about the combination of water and fire that kind of was able to chemically preserve
Yeah,
this fire?
so one of the things that we look for, so the partly a lot of the organic material that survived, so things like textile and wood, when that was affected by the fire and the heat, it effectively kind of chars the outside of those objects, and that kind of creates a skin that makes it harder for them to decay. But the benefit of waterlogging is if things are kept under water, they create what we call anaerobic conditions. So they're conditions that oxygen struggles to get to that material. And then when they were buried by the layers of sediment, that kind of almost creates like an oxygen-free environment. So the normal bugs and bacteria that would chew away on bits of wood and bits of textile, they just can't get to that material and it survives in the ground. So yeah, close to 3,000 years. So it's a very, very kind of unique set of preservation conditions, which, as I said before, are just exactly what you would hope for as an archaeologist.
Yeah, who found it originally, and was it kind of like on purpose, or did somebody stumble upon it by accident?
Well, you've picked a great set of words there because it pretty much was stumbled upon by accident. So I mentioned that the site was near a quarry. So the quarry that's there now is different from the one that was there in the past. So sort of in the middle of last century, before archaeology was really a thing, an old quarry had kind of come along and actually removed some of the site. And the quarry kind of ceased to be used and kind of went back to a reservoir. And an archaeologist, kind of on his day off, was just wandering along the side of this reservoir and noticed a couple of interesting bits of wood sticking out the side of the reservoir. And he thought, that looks a bit interesting to me. And then eventually the new kind of quarry came along, decided that they were going to kind of reopen it. So archaeologists went in to have a look at those posts that the archaeologists discovered. And it turned out they dated to the Late Bronze Age, which led us to kind of do the work that we've been doing sort of in 2015, 2016, when the main excavation happened.
Wow. And you mentioned that you were very excited to work on this project. When was the farm kind of first discovered? How long ago?
So that archaeologist who kind of stumbled across it, they first spotted the timbers in the about 1999, and then there was a sort of a couple of early excavations in the early 2000s, and an evaluation in 2006. But the kind of the big excavation, which kind of revealed the whole extent of what was there at the site, was between 2015 and 2016. And that might sound like quite a long time ago, but in fact, there was so much material. We've only just finished going through all of it and analyzing all of that data because, there was so much material here. There was work for over 50 different archaeological specialists to examine everything from pottery and the animal bones through to the tiny environmental signatures that help us to understand what the landscape would have been like in the past.
Wow. And what does that process of analysis actually look like, kind of on a practical level, when you first find a site? I'm assuming there's digging involved.
Yeah, I mean, very much. And what was really unique about this project, there was so much material and it was so densely packed that we couldn't even walk over the ground surface because we would have damaged the archaeology. So we had to create this kind of floating scaffold framework that we had to kind of lean down from so we didn't damage anything. And then during that process, we were exposing all of the different bits of wood and the architecture and all of the finds. And then they were all recorded using a technique we call photogrammetry, which produces these amazing detailed 3D models. So every single find, from tiny wood chips less than an inch long, way up to the biggest posts that were used to make the buildings, all of those were recorded and numbered. They were carefully removed from the ground, and then the kind of the real detailed specialist work began. So every one of those finds is looked at by a trained archaeologist who will write up reports on all of that stuff. And then the kind of data analysis begins, where we get of that vast trove of information and start to unpick patterns, work out what the stories were that kind of tell us what happened at that particular site.
That's really interesting. I'm also wondering, kind of like, what's the plan next? Do you know?
Well, I mean, it's a fascinating site, and we're very lucky to have basically been working on two books that really effectively tell the complete story, and they're actually being released on the 20th of March. And they'll be available open access if you're interested. You can read more about the site there online for free. And after that, we've got some other phases of work that we've done in the past that we're going to be publishing. So I mentioned those log boats earlier. There's going to be more information that we're going to be researching and studying about those. And it's possible that we may end up doing more work there in the future.
Interesting. Are you involved in the kind of writing side, or are you more involved in the analytical side?
So, so I was kind of one of the archaeologists that dug up the site, and I suppose I'm more sort of involved in the kind of communication side of this because, I love sharing the results of the work that we do, and my colleagues are some of the most amazing archaeologists and specialists out there. So it's kind of, I'm lucky enough to have the role of sharing that work with other people. I've contributed a little bit to one of the volumes, kind of discussing the sort of engagement side of things. But yeah, my real sort of passion is sharing that more widely, which is, one of the great reasons why you're able to talk to me today. It's really nice to have this opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, public engagement is really important, and I think it's really good that you're giving this talk kind of at the festival. Could you say a little bit about what people might find when they come to the talk? Why come to the talk, or what's interesting about Must Farm to us today?
So, I mean, I would say, there's, I mean, the talk itself will focus on what the detail about the site, about the kind of the specific events and the things that were going on there. And I think for me as an archaeologist, what is always amazing is if you work on a project where you can spot little moments that have happened in the past. And one of the things I love as an archaeologist is when you dig something out of the ground, you are the first person to touch that since the person who was using that in the Bronze Age. And I find that that kind of thing is so exciting. And there are so many amazing stories that are kind of coming out of this project that are just unlike anything you would normally expect with prehistory. And I would say, Prehistory is one of these areas that people don't tend to know a huge amount about. So if it's before the Romans, people tend to think of, the Stone Age or cavemen and everyone's being very, very basic and primitive. But it's sites like this that really show how sophisticated and great grasp of technology that people living in the Bronze Age had. So I think that's one of the great things that my talk kind of hopefully touches on, is sharing that a little bit more about what life would have looked like in the Bronze Age and how sometimes that can be quite unpleasant in terms of things like, we know that they have a lot of intestinal parasites because they weren't being particularly hygienic. But to kind of contrast that, there's some amazing, sophisticated things that people were using, that some of which I think we would struggle to do with the kind of skills that we have today.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they were able to build their settlement on stilts is very impressive. Is there anything else that you kind of highlight as a technological advancement that the people of Must Farm had?
So one of my absolute favourite objects that I've got a great colleague called Selena who dug this amazing find up, which is a hafted axe. So if you imagine a bronze axe that's attached to a wooden handle, but this particular type of axe was made in a way that you could actually insert different axe heads into, a bit like a modern screwdriver that you can swap different heads into. So they kind of had this amazing kind of axe multi-tool from 3,000 years ago. And again, this is one of only two examples that have ever been found from the Bronze Age. So it's little moments like this where even though the kind of the technology and the materials that they were using are probably a little bit less sophisticated than we have today, they're making everything that they need to do, the jobs that they need to do. And that's reflected again in the pots that they had. So they had over 128 different pots from the Bronze Age that are present at the site, and they range from huge storage jars that would have held about 20 liters worth of contents, all the way down to these beautiful little tiny cups that are about the size of half a chicken egg. So, this really, really rich range of different pots that pretty much a pot for every occasion, in the way that we would open our cupboard in the kitchen today, and we've got pretty much everything we need, from cereal bowls through to, serving dishes. Same thing going, in 850 BC.
That's really interesting. This is kind of a really great insight into the past that's been preserved in a way that not many sites would be.
I mean, if we were normally digging a Bronze Age site, we would probably have a couple of small post holes in the ground, maybe a couple of sherds of broken pottery and a couple of bits of butchered animal bone if we were lucky. Whereas here we have one of the most complete, I mean, we have thousands of finds, we've got thousands of pieces of timbers. I mean, this is it, basically all the stuff we're normally missing when we find a normal Bronze Age site. So it is really, really amazing in terms of the quality of what we have. But what's even more impressive is that this isn't, a special site in terms of it's, really rare. This is a site that really tells us about what's happening on an everyday basis. Because as archaeologists, we really want to understand the daily lives of the past, not just the extraordinary and the special. We want to find out what it was like on an everyday basis. So it's almost like stepping into a Bronze Age house in the same way that we would go around to someone's house today. It's finding out what would be kind of standard and what would be average. That's what's really exciting to us.
Yeah, it's amazing that it is a typical settlement, but it's just been preserved in an atypical way.
Yeah, I mean, it's exceptional preservation, but it's not preservation of the exceptional, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
That's probably a
No.
fancy way of putting it, but it's basically, it's extraordinary, but it's ordinary.
That's what makes it extraordinary.
Exactly, yeah.
No, it's really interesting. I mean, hopefully, maybe one day in the future, do you think people would be able to go and visit the site, or do you think there might not be plans for that type of thing?
So I think, as I say, that most of the site has been removed, so people will be able to see the material at various exhibitions. I mean, what would be incredible in the future is if we were able to build a recreation of one of these buildings, so people could actually, step inside one of these stilted dwellings and see what it was like. Because, there's something that it's such an evocative thing. We know so much about how they were made and what was inside them. It would, my dream is, having giving people the chance to actually step inside one of these structures. It'd be really, really extraordinary.
Yeah, and then we'd maybe really have the British Pompeii.
Well, and I think that's that, that the good thing to come out of that analogy, really, I suppose, is that snapshot in time. I think that, yeah, if people kind of step inside that and experience that just for a moment, that's what we really strive for as archaeologists, to create that connection in people with the people who are living in the past.
Yeah, but you do think that this was kind of caused by just a typical fire that might have even been just somebody cooking or something. You're not sure, I know.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's different, you know, and again, even within the team, we all have slightly different opinions. But I think, you know, it's really tempting to see this as, you know, something that's gone wrong, an accident that's happened, and basically that has led to the entire destruction of the site. But at the same time, you know, it was built in stilts over a river, it had a fence around it on the outside. So, you know, I think that there's, you know, not it's not out of the realm of possibility that some people came along and basically burnt this site down and drove the people away. So, you know, it's that real mystery that kind of keeps us even more enticed because, you know, we're always really keen to try and see if we can narrow that answer down. But, you know, it's so tantalizing because it feels like we're so close, but we're just not quite there to say exactly what happened.
That's interesting. That's all I've got for today, but thank you so much for coming to talk to us. I'd also like to say another shout out to your talk. Please do come along to Chris's talk. We'll be at 11:30 a.m. on the 23rd of March. At the University of Cambridge New Museum site.